You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in African American Studies. I am your host, Adam McNeil, PhD student in the Department of History at the University of Delaware. Today I'm chatting with Dr. Jonathan Shandell, Associate Professor and Co-Director of the Theater Arts Program at Arcadia University in Pennsylvania. We will be in discussion about his recently published book, The American Negro Theater and the Long Civil Rights Era, published by our friends at the University of Iowa Press. Welcome to the show, Dr. Shandell. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me, Adam.
No, I'm definitely excited to have you on the program today. And your book really caught my eye greatly because I thought, you know, I have a interest, you know, in theater, and it's one of those things that it's like one of those things I wish when I was younger I would have gotten into. And I recently had on the program, or I recently read, rather, Looking for Lorraine, the new third-person biography of Lorraine Hansberry. And so I read that before your book, and so it kind of re-engaged my mind on theater. So I was definitely excited to have you agree to come on the program. We're definitely excited.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. And the story of African-American theater history, particularly in the period immediately preceding Lorraine Hansberry, is one that just hasn't been told quite as much as some other periods, particularly after Hansberry. And so I'm hoping that my book helps kind of fill in an area that there's been less research and less scholarship around.
Right. And can you tell us a bit about the factors, you know, you mentioned the scholarly silence on it a bit, but what actual factors brought you into working on a project like this?
Well, I discovered the history of the American Negro Theater when I was a doctoral student, and I somehow stumbled upon the remarkable history of this theater and realized that there had been very little published on it. There was one other dissertation that had been written decades before I was looking for a dissertation topic, and that hadn't made it to a book. And there were some scattered articles here and there and mentions of the theater's history in the biographies and autobiographies of many of the artists who went through there. But the story really caught my attention. And it also was convenient because I was hoping to find a topic where I could live in Manhattan in New York and do research. And so I discovered the theater's archives and a lot of archival material at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in the New York Public Library. And it made for a good kind of coming together of different factors, an interesting story and research that I could get access to, and a story that really I felt needed to be told.
And that, you know, being able to live in New York, you know, that's living in Manhattan ain't too bad. So, you know, I could definitely see why that would be a good bit to do. And also the theater community, obviously being in that area too. I think it's always pretty cool that, you know, when you do research, you also have like a community around it that also kind of feeds into, I think, you know, the intellectual ecosystem as well. And I guess it kind of sounds like that in your case too.
Yeah, absolutely. I had an interest in African-American theater. And so there's a short section at the end of the book about the Classical Theater of Harlem. And I was actually seeing a lot of those productions as I was doing the research, and also doing the research that I was doing was in the Schomburg Center, which was formerly the Harlem Library, which is actually the building where this theater was founded. So there were a lot of factors kind of coming together that actually made it come alive for me and feel like it wasn't just an abstract project, but something that where I could really kind of see tangibly the places and the artists and the personalities that I was looking into. And that was really exciting as well.
Mm. And can you also, where did you do your graduate work as well?
Yale School of Drama. So I'm a graduate of the MFA and DFA program of the Dramaturgy and Dramatic Criticism at Yale.
All righty, man. So yeah, you definitely got that. You definitely, this is not just a fly off the wall interest then, in that case.
There you go. Yeah. And the way that program is structured is that a doctoral candidate can, if he chooses, which I did, do your research elsewhere. You don't have to live in New Haven per se to finish up your research and your writing. So I was able to be in New York, which isn't far away, and I could take the train up there to meet with my advisors and work remotely. So it was a good topic in that regard, in that I was able to live in the city that I was already living in, and as I said, kind of follow the history where it happened, which was exciting.
Very well, very well. And so getting into the book, you spoke when I brought up Lorraine Hansberry about, you know, this period really beginning in the precursor times to Hansberry, and obviously Raisin in the Sun. So can you shape the book for us a bit? Can you talk to us about how you structure your book?
Absolutely. So the first half of the book tells the story of the American Negro Theater, which existed in Harlem from 1940 to 1949, and was sort of short-lived in terms of its lifespan there. But my interest in the theater wasn't just during those 10 years that it existed, 9 or 10 years, but also thinking about its cultural legacy beyond that time. And so how the work that this theater did and the impact that it had on culture lived beyond into the 1950s and 60s, and even echoes of it right up into the present. So telling the story of what this theater's work was all about during its lifespan was one part of the project, and that makes the first half of the book. And then thinking about how the artists who got their start there and who got their training there and then went on to kind of shape American culture in the decades that followed, and think about the lines of cultural influence is the second half of the project, and that roughly takes the second half of the book.
That's exceptional. Can you also speak to us about the particular historical actors and actresses, I guess, pun intended in this case, that you deal with as well? Because I really think that it's so interesting how a lot of your theater folk are also the people that were also on the screen.
Definitely. So what the American Negro Theater has come to be most known for is as a sort of a launching pad for actors and actresses who went on to become very famous in commercial American entertainment. And so there's this list of very kind of prestigious artists who were there as young actors and actresses and got their training and then went on to be very famous and successful. Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte, Ruby Dee, and a few others as well, and Frederick O'Neill. And so partly I wanted to investigate that story and sort of find out what was it about this theater, what kind of training it offered, and what sort of work experience these actors got that positioned them well to go on and pursue those opportunities and then become famous. And for some, it was in theater and then also on the screen as well, as Hollywood started to slowly and problematically become kind of more available to Black actors. So what I found is that there really is a continuity. There really is a kind of straight line that you can draw between the approach that the theater company took to the stage and then some of the film work, particularly early in their careers for actors like Sidney Poitier and Frederick O'Neill. I spent a long time thinking I was going to have a chapter on Harry Belafonte, but it didn't quite come together in the way that I wanted. And there's an excellent biography about Belafonte's early career, which I felt I didn't really have anything to add to. So I sort of left that chapter out. But then also another person who went through the theater as an actress and actually had some success as an actress, but then shifted to playwriting and had most of her influence mm-hmm. as a playwright is Alice Childress. So I was very focused on thinking about what the continuity is between what these prestigious artists did early in their career on the stage in Harlem and then how that prepared them for the wider influence that they had once that theater collapsed, but that they matured as creative
presences in American culture. You know, the role of popular culture and the role of artistic expression in notions of what America is, right? So when you think about the Frederick Turner's Frontier thesis, though that's in the, early to mid 19th century, obviously it still spells importantly into kind of, your John Wayne Hollywood, cowboys and Indians kind of bit. And it also, in the other way for African Americans, theater and artistic expressions are ones of showing like who we are, or almost to a certain degree showing our quote unquote perfect self. Because I wrote a paper, I wrote a seminar paper for a film and historical representation course in my master's program at Simmons College. And so one of the papers I actually wrote was actually on Oscar Michaud, and kind of like his thoughts about Black different narratives of racial uplift. And to me, that to a certain degree connects back to your introductory chapter about, beyond an integrationist or separatist binary. Can you tell us a bit about why you chose that particular chapter title? I found it pretty intriguing.
Sure. Well, it really sprang out of basic fundamental thinking that I did as I started writing as to exactly what kind of story I was going to tell, exactly how I was going to position the legacy of the American Negro Theater and then of the artists who were associated with it. One of the ways, and I mentioned this a little bit, one of the ways that the American Negro Theater is known is for its influence on commercial culture. So these people who went on to become kind of commercial celebrities, Poitier and Belafonte and others. So there's a story that's told that positions the theater as a kind of a feeder of commercial entertainment. And while that's true to a certain extent, it can also be turned around to be a criticism of the ANT, that they were just commercially minded, that they were perhaps just interested more in garnering the approval of white audiences and white commercial interests rather than in telling what might be seen as a more authentic artistic vision of African-American life. And there were those criticisms levied against the theater, particularly in the 60s, Harold Cruz's book, The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, he goes on and on about this. He really sort of faults the American Negro Theater for being too commercially minded, for betraying sort of working class audiences in Harlem, and for just shooting for commercial success. So what I wanted to try to do was avoid falling into the trap either of just praising the ANT for its commercial achievements, which I think is an incomplete story, and or also for bashing them for being sellouts, which I think there's also some foundation for that, but also is an incomplete story. And so what I settled on, which is something that my advisor, David Krasner, steered me towards, and it took me a long time to figure out what exactly he was trying to help me discover, but I eventually did, was that Nikhil Singh's book, Black as a Country, kind of provides this paradigm of getting beyond just the question of, are you integrationist or separatist? And that you can look at the long civil rights era as a period where a variety of tactics and a variety of points of view and a variety of strategies are employed that African-Americans used culturally, politically, and historically to pursue their interests. And so if I took that paradigm and reread the theater's history from that point of view, it would tell a more complete picture, and it would allow me to not be put into a write myself into a corner where I'm just either labeling them as a commercial theater or labeling them as sellouts, and would be able to tell the history in a more nuanced way. So that was the paradigm that I really went with as the primary critical lens, and it ended up really becoming kind of the through line for both retelling the theater's history and the works that they produced and the achievements they had, and then looking again at the legacies of actors like Sidney Poitier and Frederick O'Neill, who also have come upon some criticism for being Hollywood sellouts. And while I think some of that criticism is valid, of course, particularly in the case of Poitier, that's been sort of the primary line of criticism against him. I also felt that there was another story there that could be told about particularly some of his early work in film and how he was pursuing an agenda that went beyond just commercialism and beyond just catering to white audiences. So that critical lens allowed me the flexibility to kind of think about all of this work in a variety of ways, and to be able to tell what I hope is a complete and nuanced story about this period in cultural
and
history.
It's so wild that you mentioned the perception of Sidney Poitier, especially, you know, once he became, you know, a commercial kind of who's coming to dinner style figure. and I think it's a great way to connect back to 100 years back to the 19th century, where, you know, more of my foray historically is to somebody like Frederick Douglass. And so I'm actually interviewing David Blight about his new biography of Frederick Douglass. And I think it's appropriate to bring this up because one of the central themes of his text is actually that I think the connection to really is to it that what happens when you are on the fringe kind of from your beginning, right? So where you might be deemed more radical in your expressions and also like the kind of roles, I guess, in the case of Poitier, he would take in and where he wouldn't have become thought of as a sellout. But then once he kind of, you know, becomes mainstream, that kind of bit comes on to where he's more centralized, right? So what happens when you go from being an outsider to an insider? You know, and so, you know, I think that that's I think that's an interesting juxtaposition and really parallel between the centuries too, because both, you know, were in their day one of if not the leading members of the Black community, the African American community, though Poitier is from the Bahamas, but but yeah, I think that, you know, that kind of representation is there, you know, and it really makes me think a bit about, you know, Sidney Poitier as such an intriguing figure historically.
Yeah, and one of my favorite pieces of research for that chapter, and really for the whole book, was actually an essay that James Baldwin wrote about Sidney Poitier, and they were friendly and they knew each other and they interacted a little bit. But it was in essence Baldwin's defense of Poitier once he was coming under attack for being the magic Negro and, you know, taking all these like sort of emasculated and disempowered roles. And Baldwin wrote this defense of him, which basically echoed or revisited some of those criticisms, I should say, and said that rediscovered some of Poitier's earlier films that weren't as commercially famous and found a kind of a different presence on screen for him. And then also said that ultimately he had the tragedy of Poitier's career was that he had become so absorbed by a system that everybody knew had to change. And so that was kind of the difficult position that he was in, was that he was trying to effect change from the inside of a ultimately kind of corrupt Hollywood culture. And it's a very kind of sympathetic way of reading Poitier, but I wanted to take up some of what Baldwin was saying to make the argument that even though those attacks on Poitier are somewhat valid, given how problematic many of his roles on screen were, that there's still a different side to the story, that there's still a different kind of a presence and perhaps maybe even a sort of subtle subtextual resistance to the objectification of African Americans on the Hollywood screen that Poitier was bringing to his work. And that it's more visible earlier in his career, right when he came out of the American Negro Theater, and that perhaps over time he became so kind of accustomed to working commercially in Hollywood that side of his artistry was lost.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And can you also, you know, I think the role that theater and the arts, like, I think the role that they play in society is, to me, one of the more interesting phenomena. And so, I thought that your chapter, Black Selfhood and Interracial Communion in the Drama of Alice Childress, was really, was pretty interesting to me, because when I think about, you know, going back to like the slave narratives and black and the black tradition, you know, I think about, you know, how people craft themselves, you know, how people, you know, because effectively, like, if you're someone who's in this field, then that means that you are in some ways like taking portions of your life or, you know, other people's lives and crafting it onto a particular screen or crafting them for audiences. And so in a time where black freedom is still not there, you know, I think that those kind of stories are very important, especially when you think about how does that work when you know there has to be an interracial component at some point in it. And so could you kind of speak, would you be able to speak to that a bit, if you can?
Sure, sure. Childress is such an interesting figure. And as I mentioned earlier, she was trained as an actress in the American Negro Theater. And she actually achieved success as an actress. And she even got a Tony Award nomination on Broadway. But as she went on in her career, she discovered that she was deeply dissatisfied with the types of roles that were available to her as a black woman. And both in racial terms and in gender terms, she felt that she was double stereotyped as a black woman on stage. And she came to understand that if she was going to find artistic fulfillment and be able to kind of express her authentic self, that she would have to actually create the roles and write plays that honored who she felt she was. And so she shifted from acting to playwriting and became a really well-regarded voice on the African-American theater. And one of those playwrights that comes before Lorraine Hansberry, who now doesn't quite get as much recognition, doesn't quite get as much study, doesn't quite get as much publication or production, but was one of the, sort of the precursors to Hansberry in the decade that preceded her. So I was interested in thinking about how Childress's work as an actress with this Harlem Theater Company fueled both her professional acting that she did later and then also her playwriting. And given the interracial character of a lot of the work that the American Negro Theater was doing, it led me to focus on the plays that she wrote in the 1950s and early 60s that used interracial casts. So she has another phase of her playwriting later in the 60s and 70s that are all African-American casts and are more directly focused on issues of Black identity and Black community. But earlier in her career, she wrote these plays that featured integrated casts and were very much engaged with interracial relations. And that really drew my attention. And so I was trying to figure out how her portrayals of Black identity within an interracial social context could be seen in these various ways associated with the long civil rights era, both as a kind of a defiant political stance for equal rights and for resisting racism and racial oppression on one hand, but also on the other hand, as kind of statements of hope for interracial partnership, interracial communication, interracial intimacy even. And so the plays reward those readings from different points of view. And that's what I sort of tried to do in the chapter, is to say that we don't have to choose in thinking about Childress. Is she either a kind of a voice of Black self-determination on one hand, or is she a voice of integrationist politics on the other hand? Her plays are rich enough and layered enough that you can kind of see them fulfilling both of those goals at the same time. And so the plays that I read in particular, one is called Florence, which is a one-act play she wrote in 1950. And then another is called Trouble in Mind, which was commercially successful in New York in the mid-50s, 1956 and 57. It was optioned for Broadway but never made it to Broadway because she refused to rewrite the play to the satisfaction of the white producers that were going to fund it, and so it never actually made it to the Broadway stage. And then another play, which is probably her most famous and most widely revived play, called Wedding Band, which was in the early 60s and is the story of an interracial marriage in the South, and was actually written and staged and produced in the years leading up to Loving versus Virginia, which was 1967. So this play was actually like sort of taking on the issue while interracial marriage was still illegal throughout the South and in dozens of states in the United States. So there's both a kind of a defiance of the racial hegemony of the United States in the way that she tells this story, but then also by featuring this interracial couple and kind of investing a lot of dignity in their relationship and in their marriage and in the ways that that these two characters love each other and try to be together, there is a kind of a statement of hope that perhaps not only interracial romance, but kind of, you know, understanding between Blacks and whites in a racially divided United States is possible if society will allow it. So that's the ways that I really tried to show her work, her drama, existing across a spectrum of political points of view and strategies for combating discrimination and prejudice in the United States in the mid 20th century.
You know, and I'm so glad you brought up these points, especially the Loving point. And, you know, I think this is the 50th year or around the 50th year of the decision, and you know, the relationships and the children that have been born since then. You know, it's an interesting historical tale. But then I also have recently thought about the role of, you know, as historians, the role of non-historians in the creation or in the articulation of historical stories, if my idea is right. And can you speak to how the American Negro Theater, and I actually didn't even have this question planned, it just was on the spot, so please indulge the freestyle here. Can you speak to the role? Thanks. Can you speak to the role that producers of, you know, the American Negro Theater, in how they effectively were historians in a sense, in their stories?
Sure, sure. Well, and I think this is sort of my interest in theater history and in cultural history more broadly, is thinking about not only how cultural narratives, plays, and, you know, for this book, and this is sort of new areas to me, but thinking about film and TV as well, how the stories that get told in the United States both reflect the present reality of race relations in the nation, and then also perhaps how they help push forward to change the culture and to change society, or at least envision how society might change through the lens of a fictional narrative. So the American Negro Theater in the 1940s was certainly creating stories and using narratives in a way that was both reflective of what was happening at the time and then also potentially forward-looking into how, where society might go. So I mentioned Childress's play Wedding Band, which is about an interracial romance in the that she wrote in the mid-60s, but the ANT staged a play called The Garden of Time, which was an adaptation of Medea by, Euripides' Greek tragedy, Medea, and it sort of recast the story with in interracial terms, so that Medea was a black character and Jason, her Greek lover, was white. And that too was a kind of a meditation, not only on interracial romance, but sort of metaphorically on race relations and sort of the possibility for racial progress. And it keeps the kind of tragic result of the play with Medea killing her children and all that from the original. But again, there is this kind of poetic and metaphoric consideration of the fact that how might that story have been avoided? How might society have opened up to allow for these people to love each other and respect each other and be together? So that's just one example. More prominent in the history of the ANT and also in the book, which gets a whole chapter, is this play that they produced, which became very successful, called Anna Lucasta. And this was a play that they produced in Harlem that was incredibly successful and was actually picked up by Broadway producers and brought to Broadway and became very successful. It ran for more than 2 years on Broadway with an all African-American cast, which was kind of groundbreaking at the time and actually is still the record for the longest Broadway run of any play that has an all African-American cast. And this play was sort of remarkable in that it was kind of an early experiment with what we might now call non-traditional casting or colorblind casting. The play tells the story of a family in Pennsylvania and their attempt to marry their daughter to a someone who comes up from Alabama with a lot of money, and they want to marry off their daughter, who's kind of the black sheep of the family, no pun intended. But she is kind of disgraced and working as a prostitute. And they want to marry her off to kind of steal the money of this young man who had come up from Alabama. And the way that the story is told is without any reference to racial identity, to race, to the blackness of the characters. And That might not be so remarkable now if we saw that kind of a story, but in 1944, this was actually quite remarkable that you could have these black actors on stage embodying these characters and not being constantly marked by race, by racial caricature, by any references to African-American culture or history. And it came during World War II in 1944, and it was a comedy, and it was incredibly successful. And I try to build an argument in this chapter that this play, which I find to be kind of a mediocre play at best, but the way that it was kind of envisioning what we might call a kind of a post-racial experience or a kind of a race-blind experience where audiences of all points of view could watch a drama of serious characters, well-rounded characters, well-defined characters, just have a kind of a typical comic romance story without a constant reference and a constant obsession with their racial identity and without resorting to kind of obvious caricature and stereotyping, was in some sense a kind of a gesture of proposing to the nation what would it look like to view African Americans outside of the prism of race, right? Outside of the paradigm of racial hierarchy. And the play's success and commercial success, and then it went on, and there were actually two different film versions created, first with a white cast, because Hollywood wasn't ready to make this story into a feature film with a black cast, and that was in the early 50s. And then in the late 50s, they remade it with an African-American cast with some of the original cast from the Broadway production. But that also sort of goes to show that that the fact that you could take this story and make two different films, one with a white cast and one with a black cast, speaks something to an appetite for viewing characters outside of traditional notions of racial identity and racial hierarchy. And it was very successful, but also the commercial success and the lack of racial content in the play was also something that opened up the ANT to criticisms that they were selling out, that they were playing to white audiences, that they were aiming for Broadway success, and that they weren't using their art to give voice to a true, authentic black experience. So I was really interested in the kind of the tension that surrounded that and the ways that the theater was trying to kind of negotiate that that complexity in what they were doing.
In the last portion of our interview, I've been doing, you know, my interviews for about a year now. And so I try to every now and again, try to do something a little different. And so would you be able to talk to us a bit about, you know, with you writing this book, The American Negro Theater and the Long Civil Rights Era, can you tell us a bit about, you know, some of your favorite moments about doing the research for this project?
Sure. Sure. One that leaps to mind has to do with this play, Anna Lucasta, which I was just talking about, which makes the whole chapter. And the history, the textual history of this play is really interesting and complex. It was originally written in the late 30s by a Polish-American writer named Philip Jordan. And he wrote this play, and it was had a slightly different title. It was called Anna Lucasta. And the characters were specifically defined as Polish. He tried to get this play performed, tried to get it produced, and nobody liked it, nobody wanted it, nobody produced it. It ended up in the hands of the leader of the ANT. His name was Abram Hill, and he read it, and he said, well, obviously, we're not going to produce a play that's about a Polish family, but if we could get the playwright's permission to change things and to change the identity of the characters and to do some rewrites, it might work very well. And so they got that permission from Jordan, the original playwright, and they changed it quite a bit. That became problematic because then the play started making money, but Jordan retained the author's credit And he continued to make the author's royalty, even though his play had really been changed quite a bit by the actors and the theater into what it was. So there was always a question of how different the play that made it to Broadway and made a lot of money on Broadway was when compared to the original manuscript that Philip Yordan wrote in the late 30s. But nobody had ever been able to actually make that comparison. But through some digging, I actually found the original script in the archives of the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts at Lincoln Center. And it was in some uncatalogued boxes of files from Philip Yordan's agent that had never really been gone through. And so by finding a record in the catalog, said that had these uncatalogued records, and I asked for permission and they let me sort of dig through it, and I found this manuscript, and it was one of those like lost treasure moments, which was very memorable and really gratifying. And then I was really able to make that comparison, to take the script that I had and compare it to the original that they started from, and understand and be able to write about and analyze exactly how that script was changed, and understand that that original that the white playwright wrote didn't get any interested producers for a commercial production because it wasn't good at all. That it really was the work of the ANT in improving it and in making it something that people had an interest in. So that came far too late for the people to actually get compensated for their efforts. And there's a whole kind of commercial history of this that is distasteful, in that the white producers and the white playwright were the ones who really got rich off of this, while the black artists who were most responsible for this really never got fairly compensated. And that kind of fits in quite well with American cultural history writ large, in that too often it's whites who sort of come in and co-opt African American culture and turn it into a commercial project and make profits off of that, where the original artists kind of remain in obscurity. So it fit within that larger story. But the discovery of that manuscript, to answer your question, your original question, was quite a memorable moment in the research, and enabled a different kind of analysis than had ever been done on this.
And I like asking that particular question because I always feel that, you know, to keep a book project going and to, you know, your writing is not always going to be the best on every single day. You're not always going to have those, you know, moments where you can write 2,000 words in a day or some wildness like that. But it's those moments in the archive, right, where you find something or that begins the process, or, you know, helps you to continue it, I think are always important to really flesh out, especially for those who are going to get this book, because we already know New Books in African American Studies, listeners always go out and buy the books. So buy this book, y'all. I hope so as well. University of Iowa Press,
hope so.
First time with you guys. Thank you. And so with that being said as well, can one last question, if you don't mind. If you had the opportunity to have three of your historical actors, actresses in front of you for a 5-course dinner, for about 4 hours, and you can ask them individually or collectively 3 questions, right? 3 like huge, like long durée kind of questions, right? What would they be?
Wow, that is such a great question to ask.
So as you formulate your thoughts, I was going to say, to contextualize it a little more, to give you a little more time to think, this question comes really from the thought of, if you're going to write, you know, a book that's, you know, 200 or so pages and invest your time and your family's time, because you always see families in the acknowledgments too, that this is something that is obviously something that's largely a part of you. And so there, obviously not everyone's like Sidney Poitier where they're alive. And so by technicality, you could ask them a question, but not everybody is. So with that being said, you know, I think, you know, providing that context is good too, because it lets people know that, you know, fantasy is everything. How these characters come into be large times is literally because of daydreaming and fantasies about a different life. And really, that's the crux of what, you know, Black life has been for, you know, in the Western world for 500
years. Yeah, well, and before I answer your question, I will also kind of go back and add on to my previous answer and to say that another joy of doing the research for this book was to work in the archive of Jim Hatch, who's a like sort of legendary historian of African-American theater, and he has a private collection of oral histories that he and his students at the City University of New York did, interviewing Black artists, actors, writers, etc., that he just sort of keeps in his loft in Soho. And so a lot of the research was playing his old reel-to-reel tapes and listening to the voices of the very people that I was writing about. And I was actually able to interview some folks who were involved with the American Negro Theater, but I was also able to listen to the voices of those, particularly those who had deceased before I started my research, because they were recorded in this oral history collection. And that's a real treat for a historian who doesn't always get the chance to hear the real voice and hear the real turns of phrase recorded of the subjects that they study. So in a sense, I already have sat down and listened to the wisdom of these people. But I didn't get to ask the questions. So back to your question. I mean, I suppose one question that I would really want to hear from them would be to hear their own thoughts about the work of the American Negro Theater and how it intersected with and expressed their sense of themselves as African Americans. As I mentioned, one of the kind of historic lines of criticism of the ANT was that it was too integrationist, that it was too geared toward white commercial interests, and thus did not authentically and fully kind of express an African-American point of view. I tried to push back against that charge in the way that I think about the theater's history, but I would love to hear their response to that question specifically when they were producing this work, when they were doing what they were doing in Harlem. What did they think it meant to them as African Americans? What did they think it meant to the Harlem community? And how did they see themselves? How did they see their work with respect to racial integrity, if I can kind of use that phrase, as compared to with respect to its commercial possibilities? That's the basic question that I tried my best to answer throughout the book, and I would love to know if I got it right.
All phenomenal. And like I said, I like asking that because I think it's, you know, I just think it's really cool to just kind of like think about that kind of thing too. And because, you know, who knows? You may end up having that chance in a different life, and those kind of possibilities are, I think, you know, so, you know, those are things that keep us coming back to these great books, and also to keep writing as well, and to keep thinking. With that being said, with those last two, can you speak to us about any of your new projects or future projects as well? Because I know this book is you know, pretty new, and you know, it's looking great and looking at it in my room. You know, could you indulge us in telling us about a bit about what's coming up new for you?
I wish I had a better answer. At this point, I haven't really started another project. I'm very involved in some service work for my college, and that has prevented me from starting anything new that's significant. And so I had this big push to finish this up and get this out, and I haven't yet decided on what the next chapter is. I think I want to stay in the realm of African-American theater history and stay in the period that I've been working, the 1940s and 1950s, again, just because it seems like that's a place where there are stories out there still to be told, and where compared to what was happening in the 60s and compared to the Harlem Renaissance before that and other periods that are more well researched, that's it seems like there's a need for that. I did recently learn about this theater that existed in Greenwich Village in the early and mid 1950s called the Greenwich Muse Theater. And it also did experiments with racially integrated casting and what we call colorblind casting or non-traditional casting. And part of it was that it was actually run by a woman who was blind. And that seemed like an interesting story to me that might be worth digging into. And I don't know what's out there. I don't know if there are any archives. And I think it only existed for even a shorter period of time, 6 or 7 years. But perhaps there's some materials about them, about this theater, about the plays that they produced, and about who this woman who ran it, and her name is even escaping me at the moment, and what her interest in race on stage was all about. And I guess what I'm most interested in and want to keep following is the question of American culture before the traditionally call the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement really exploded, and race came more to the fore of American culture and American political discourse. I want to know what role the theater was playing to help engage the public in questions of racial identity, questions of integration, questions of racial justice, perhaps when it was a little bit below the radar of the mainstream American consciousness. That's still where my interest is. So I imagine I'll try to find a project that's somewhere in that zone, but I don't know what it is yet.
Sounds good. Sounds good. And just know that you will always have an open invitation back to New Books in African American Studies. And you know, it's always great to really, you know, get out of my 18th and 19th century time frame and be able to talk to someone who could actually talk to real people. It's so profound. I just don't know how y'all do it. Like that, they can actually talk back to you.
Well, I appreciate very much your doing this podcast, and as a graduate student, it's probably you probably have a lot of other things to do as well. But I've been listening to some of the episodes, and to be able to highlight the work of scholars and make those conversations more visible or more audible, I should say, is a great service, and I hope you'll continue to do it.
Most definitely, it's been an exceptional year. I am just blessed and honored to be able to have, you know, not only folks from around the nation, but also around the world, even to be able to chat with them and for them to listen in on our conversations. And just to let y'all know, if over the last 51 minutes and 51 seconds, you don't know who the heck we're talking to none other than Dr. Jonathan Shandell, professor at Arcadia University in PA. About his phenomenal book published by our new friends, or at least my new friends, at the University of Iowa Press, entitled The American Negro Theater and the Long Civil Rights Era. Thank you so much for coming on the program today, Doctor, and we cannot wait to have you on the program once more.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I enjoyed it a lot.
All righty, folks. Chatting live from New Books in African American Studies, Newark, Delaware, University of Delaware. I am your host, PhD student in the Department of History at the University of Delaware. I am your host, Adam McNeil. Over and out.